is The End User, episode 166 for Tuesday, April 1st. Facebook is everting. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. And Chris, it's a good day for the future because the iPad app for Microsoft Office is finally available.
Yeah, and that took a while, didn't it?
It certainly did. The iPad's been out for almost 4 years, and they only got the Office app this week. And in order to do it, read certain Office documents, you need to have, and we knew this, but it's still kind of sad, you need to have a Microsoft Office 365 subscription.
Right, and we already knew that that was going to be the case, more or less. But you can't expect them to put these applications on the iPad and not charge for them, right?
Well, sure, but there is an easier way to charge for apps on the iPad, and that is to charge for the app when you buy it.
See, but with that, that means that Apple would get a 30% cut, and I don't think when you offer a subscription in this way that Apple gets the same cut.
That is probably a big part of the reason that they're doing it this way.
Yeah.
But still.
Yeah, it's just, it goes to show that if you are kind of a large software company, it's kind of difficult to release apps for the platform in a way that I think would make more sense for the consumer, because you definitely don't want to give up 30%. You know, that's fine for little one-off developer shops, but for a company whose livelihood is making software, that isn't quite as tenable.
Yeah, indie game developers can totally afford a 30% cut, but Microsoft, a giant corporation, cannot.
Yeah, I guess maybe that is a little backwards, isn't it? No, but I think Microsoft is not a company that needs the promotion of being in the App Store, right? The App Store helps smaller developers get discovered, and as a kind of service fee, Apple takes a 30% cut.
Sure, I see what you're saying, but Microsoft has apparently decided it needs to be on the iPad, and there's only one way to get on the iPad, and I guess this is another way to charge for it.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to put instructions on how to jailbreak an iPad up on Microsoft.com and then provide installers or anything like that.
That would be hilarious if that's what they did.
That would be kind of hilarious. but I think what's a little, the bigger picture is a little more interesting, is that I bet you they've had these applications baked and ready for a while now, and they were just waiting. And it could be tied to Steve Ballmer, who knows? But I feel like they've had these applications just kind of waiting in the wings for a little while.
Well, that would be too bad for them because according to an opinion piece by Sam Makovich at Ars Technica, he's saying that so many people have been trying to use the iPad as a primary use device,
right,
for so long without Microsoft Office. That a lot of these people have moved on. They've figured out a way to avoid using Office, and they're probably not going to start shelling out $100 a year now in order to get back into that ecosystem.
Yeah, at least on a personal level. I think the story might be a little bit different in the enterprise, though.
Yeah,
so
is absolutely true. And Microsoft actually has also launched an enterprise management app suite for the iPad as well.
And Rennie there in the chat is saying it might kill the Surface, but I don't buy that. I understand that Office was a big competitive advantage for the Surface, but ultimately I think their success at large in the industry is not the Surface. It is Windows and Office. It is software. They're a software company, and I think they're, whether or not it might kill the Surface is almost beside the fact that they should be offering software for a very popular platform. And I think that was the question for a long time at Microsoft is, okay, well, we're at least developing these applications, and do we really want to put the software that makes our hardware have an advantage onto other platforms? And I think ultimately when you look at what they're doing, that is indeed the right decision. So, you know, obviously you can't tell what the future is going to hold, but I think embracing their core as a software company is going to be the right decision.
I totally agree with you. And it's also worth pointing out that even if the Surface dies, there's no way to know whether Office for iPad is the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah, I just feel like they're just leaving money at the table, you know, hoping that the Surface would take off and that Office would be some kind of differentiator. And I think if the Surface is going to take off, it's not going to be because they've got Office when no one else does. I don't think that is a point that would resonate with a lot of people. Again, perhaps businesses, but I just feel like you want to have your software in front of as many eyes possible. And if that's your objective, you need to be on both Android and iOS at this point in time. And
well, maybe that's what they were hoping. Maybe they were hoping Office would be the killer app for the Surface, and that simply turned out not to be the case. It wasn't driving enough sales of the product. And so that's when they decided that wasn't going to be an effective strategy, that's when they decided to release this software for the iPad.
And then also looking at it, you know, I just said that it might not kill the Surface, but really it might kill the Surface, right? Because that was a pretty large advantage.
I don't think that anyone is going to stop buying the Surface because of this. I don't think a lot of people are going to buy the Surface. I don't think a lot of people were buying the Surface. So I don't think that this is going to make or break it, and I don't think that we will know either way.
Yeah, true. No way of knowing.
It's definitely something that Microsoft has considered.
So from what we can tell for these applications, what do you think of the actual interface and that kind of thing? Is this a good app for people to have?
I can definitely think of some people already who are going to love it as it is, if they haven't tried it already. It's obviously missing a lot of features, especially in Excel and PowerPoint.
To be expected, right?
Yeah, of course it's to be expected. Is a first release product. I imagine they'll be adding features as they continue to develop and improve it. But so I think it's a good first release app. You know, Microsoft doesn't have too much experience making first class apps for the iPad.
Yeah, and I think what they've done is kind of interesting here. They still have this kind of pseudo touch interface. It's like they've got the ribbon up top. And the targets are a little smaller than normal. But for whatever reason, I think that that is actually more, that is a better UI for the kind of application that they've got here. I don't think anyone using Office applications is going to like, you know, big bubbly iPad app kind of look and feel. I think that if you're using Excel on a tablet like this, you're either going to hook up an external device to input stuff, or you're going to, you know, just be making updates or something like that and viewing more than creating in it. So I think that is kind of reflected in the UI.
Yeah, the one thing that I haven't figured out if they have yet is a presentation mode. That is something that people are going to want to work very well very soon.
Yeah, so ultimately, Office on the iPad and also on Android phones and you know, the smaller iOS phone devices, the iPhones, I think that Microsoft as a software company is going to win. They're going to make more money selling Office than they would selling services.
Even though they're not charging any money now to use the Office iPhone and Android phone apps.
Yeah, so for the moment, the way it's working out is that you can view any application, you can view any document for free on all of the devices I just listed. And if you want to make edits and save in any way, you've got to pay up for the Office 365 for $99 a year. So, and again, you know, I think that's to be expected. That seems to be the model going forward, with at least with applications like this that have this kind of back end, right?
Right, but the new versions of the iPhone and Android app of Office Mobile are now completely free to view and edit content. you no longer require an Office 365 subscription.
Right. So again, ultimately, I think the bigger story is that it in fact exists now, and we'll be waiting for people to kind of get their hands on and, you know, see how Microsoft treats it going down the road.
Well, I will try to do a test and report back, although I do not have an Office 365 subscription, so I won't be able to test all the features.
And I have had Office on my phone for a long time, so I will not be able to do that. I also don't use it very often, for what it's worth.
Well, I'm actually in a position where I can compare the Office for iPad version and the Office RT for the Surface.
Cool. Yeah. So that'll be a good comparison when we actually get around to getting it on your iPad.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move into some kind of wacky news. Facebook is going to buy Oculus VR for $2 billion. And that's part cash, part stock deal. And the internet kind of exploded when this news came out. There was a lot of anger that I saw floating around. But ultimately, I'm not sure what Facebook's angle on this buying a virtual reality headset company is. I think maybe they're just looking to diversify their business in some way.
I think that they are trying to compete directly with Sony, because we reported last week that Sony is working on their own virtual reality headset.
Yeah, well, they've had to have been working on this deal for some amount of time. I mean, I guess we've had rumors of Sony working on virtual reality for a little while as well. But, you know, I would expect that Microsoft and the Xbox platform would get on that bandwagon before Facebook would.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg is starting to become famous for these last-minute round number.
Yeah, true.
No forewarning buyouts. This is pretty much exactly what he did with Instagram. It was just all of a sudden Facebook buys Instagram for $1 billion.
Yeah, and you know, looking at it from Oculus VR's perspective, somebody flops $2 billion down the table, and you can't say no to that, right?
Especially not if you are Oculus. They are working on developing cutting-edge technology that is really expensive and has been really expensive for them. And I'm sure that they are dying to get a version of this product to market. And $2 billion is going to help them do that.
Yeah, so they at least delivered on their Kickstarter where they were able to get the developer's kits out. But yeah, they don't really have a consumer-facing product yet. Now, I don't think they're going to have a consumer-facing product for some time now.
Well, however long that amount of time is, it would have been longer if they weren't bought for this.
Yeah, it kind of extends the runway for them, doesn't it? So, looking at it from Facebook's side, I really got to think that they're just going to let it be its own thing, especially at first. I can't imagine Facebook, rolling out like a Facebook app for the Oculus Rift. I don't really see how that fits together, but the best thing I've been able to come up with is that Facebook is just trying to diversify their business. You know, they're this single monolithic company that has one huge success in Facebook, and you know, they've been buying some other companies that are kind of tangential to the Facebook functionality, and maybe this is them starting to just diversify and hedge their bets a little bit. You know, if Facebook the application goes down for whatever reason in the next 5 years, you know, it happened to MySpace before Facebook.
Then it happened to AOL before them.
Yes, indeed. And you know, AOL didn't really go anywhere, but they lost all of the mind share for the most part. But I got to think this is just them saying, "Hey, that's a cool product. We should get those guys here and help them with more resources to innovate and move forward with the product that they're envisioning." And Facebook would like to be a part of that just to kind of diversify.
I'm with you on this one. I think that they are just trying to diversify, and they see a technology with a lot of potential that could use capital investment. And I think that's all that they're trying to do here. Who knows what the future will bring? I mean, at some point, if Facebook's plan goes well, I'm sure that there will be a lot of crossover between the Oculus Rift or whatever succeeds it and Facebook or whatever succeeds it. But that's not going to happen for a long time from now, and there's no way that they can predict how it's going to happen.
Yeah, and you know, I think it could be a flop, too. That's the other side of the coin. And if it were a flop, they'd say, okay, well, we got some interesting technology. Perhaps they've got some patents, and there's still some value in there. So I don't see Facebook and Oculus crossing streams really anytime in the near future, at very least. But yeah, I do see it as just a diversification play.
Perhaps this is beginning of Neal Stephenson's metaverse, the version of the internet where everyone uses VR goggles to navigate a virtual world full of nightclubs and avatars.
Well, that sounds deeply disturbing.
Well, if you hadn't read Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, that would be a good read to find out one way that this technology could go. And it actually would be a real consequence of the combination of Oculus Rift and Facebook.
Yeah, and I haven't read Snow Crash yet. It's been sitting on my shelf for like 3 years at this point. I should get on that, huh?
Okay, but this is real pure sci-fi fodder. I mean, there was that Bruce Willis movie a year or so ago about how everyone sat in their basements with VR and interacted with Android avatars in the real world, right? And you would need something like the Oculus Rift to make that happen.
Yes, you definitely would.
Just about all of the science fiction of the late 80s and early 90s involved a VR headset.
And I guess you've got to have a company that's serving the ads on the VR headset, right?
You have to have a company that is creating the space that we inhabit inside the virtual world. And Facebook could be that company. They could make that space. So the new Facebook would be a virtual world where you interact with all of your friends.
Yeah, I guess I could see some of that bleed together, but it's seriously far off in the future.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, but this is the beginning of it right here, potentially.
Yeah, yeah.
The aversion of Facebook into a real virtual world.
All right, well, we'll have to wait another decade for that kind of prediction to pan out, and we'll see. We'll see how that goes, but it's kind of truly shocking news, I think. So let's move on from our VR and Facebook news, and let's get into some Android news. HTC has released their newest flagship Android device. They're calling it the HTC One M8.
And the old HTC One is now called the HTC One M7.
Right. And I don't know why they decided to differentiate this based upon the letters M8. It seems kind of wacky. And also, they always spell it like HTC One, open parentheses, M8, close parentheses. So, I don't know. I think that naming is kind of a failure. But what is not a failure is the device itself. From everything I can see about this device, it is probably the best phone on the market at this current point in time. You know, that torch gets handed off pretty quickly in Android land, but this is going to be it for now. It's a 5-inch screen. It's got a 1080p screen on it. It's a 2.3 gigahertz Snapdragon 801 quad-core processor. Got 2 gig of RAM in there and 32 gig for storage. So that is completely modern hardware, right? And, you know, not that much of a bump from the HTC One in the first place, which was also pretty fantastic for its day.
Yeah, they've increased the size to the now standard 5-inch diagonal 1080p display. And I believe that is a super LCD display.
So if they keep making phones bigger, eventually they're going to turn into virtual reality headsets, aren't they?
It's very possible, yeah. And that would explain all the high resolution that our eyes can't see at 12 inches from the phone.
Right. I could imagine, you know, everybody's walking around looking at their smartphone anyway. You might as well just put it on your face.
You might as well, yeah, that's right.
So
then no one will be able to tell the difference between the virtual world that they see and the real world that they inhabit.
Right. We will eventually become batteries. It's the first step.
This is really the sci-fi singularity apocalypse show, isn't it?
I guess so. I guess
every
so.
Every product that we review is the end of the world.
Yeah, from now on, all products are Skynet to me. All of them. So let's get back into the one. It's got an interesting... Here's an interesting feature. It's got a 5-megapixel cam on the front, and they've got this weird dual camera on the back so that when you take a picture, you can like you can do things that require a slight amount of depth perception. So, for example, you can like blur out the background and that kind of thing. So stuff that requires a small amount of depth perception can use this kind of dual camera to get at the that kind of functionality. So I don't really know what people are going to do with that, but it's there, and it would be kind of cool to see someone take advantage of it.
Yeah, I like it. It's pretty cool. It's an interesting idea. Obviously, you're not going to be able to make a good use of any kind of 3D camera on a two-dimensional smartphone. They tried to do it. It didn't catch on. But just having that extra camera there to do something to differentiate it from everyone else is interesting and probably not all that expensive to include.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be like the Lytro camera or anything like that, but I think it introduces some kind of interesting post-processing kind of capabilities. So they've also got this bizarre case. It's a case that on the front of it, it's a flip cover, and on the front of it, there's a bunch of divots, a bunch of dots arranged in a grid, almost like Battleship or something. And they have a bunch of LEDs that can shine through the case to, light up the time and the weather.
Yeah, that's pretty strange. I mean, it's cool.
Yeah, it is neat.
But is it the best way to make an informational display into a case?
No, I think it's just for fun, I think. I don't think anyone would engineer this or look at this and say, oh, okay, that is the most functional thing I could possibly have. But I think it's just kind of a neato factor.
Well, I have one other neato factor to mention about the HTC One M8, and that is its repairability. iFixit has already got their hands on one and
nice.
Completely taken it apart and scored it 2 points out of 10. Now, the original HTC One scored a 1 out of 10, or maybe it was a 0. I don't know if they give zeros, but it was pretty much their lowest score because you could not open the original HTC One without damaging it unless you had a proprietary tool that only HTC has and doesn't give or sell anyone. Now, the new HTC One gets a 2 instead of a 1 because you no longer need that proprietary tool that's impossible to get. You can take it apart with tools that exist in the real world. The problem is, it's very, very difficult.
So at least they're moving in the right direction, but
not very
far. All right, well, let's get out of Android news. Let's get into the afterburners. Taylor, do you have your seatbelt ready?
Hang on a second. Okay, ready to go.
All right. So Chromecast is adding support for RDO, Crackle, and Vudu. So we've talked about the Chromecast before, and it allows you to stream content to whatever device the Chromecast is hooked up to over HDMI, and that's just three more apps that have the capability to support it. So it's good to see the platform grow a little bit.
Yeah, that's great. I've been waiting for Chromecast to get more apps since its introduction. Now, we mentioned the new Chromebox from Asus. It's $179. It runs Chrome OS out of the box. It's got a 16 gigabyte SSD built in and all your standard ports. It weighs 1.3 pounds. And now we have a review from Ars Technica saying it's pretty great if you want to run Chrome OS, but if you're trying to repurpose it for some other operating system, that's going to be tricky.
So it does look like a cool little box. You know, it's a cheap little box, and if that's what you expect from it and you want to run Chrome OS, that looks like a pretty interesting option. So Samsung has introduced its first line of smart light bulbs here, and they're running on top of the they're running on top of Bluetooth. Presumably it's Bluetooth LE, and it's the first time we've seen Samsung jump into this. So they are such a big company, they can make a pretty big splash in any market they enter. So if I were LG and Philips, I would be shaking in my boots.
And another reason Samsung's competitors are shaking in their boots is that they have just launched a new budget model 4K display. I say budget model because it's available for pre-order for $699, but it is quite the looker. It's 28 inches, and it has supposedly a full 1 billion color display gamut, and it has two HDMI sockets and one DisplayPort. It's a pretty great looking screen. It's already sold out on pre-orders on Amazon.
So Stripe, which is a company that processes payments on behalf of other companies, is going to start accepting Bitcoin. So more wide adoptance of Bitcoin. It's been an interesting ride thus far.
It has indeed. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing this from PayPal or Square pretty soon.
Yeah, definitely. So that will do it for the afterburners. Taylor, you can undo your seatbelt.
Okay, good. It was getting uncomfortable.
You can take it easy, and let's get into the end user stories. What do we got up front here?
Okay, so this has to do with emoji. Now, I'm talking specifically about Unicode emoji, the kind that you can add to your iOS device by adding the internet or international keyboards. Chris, do you have access to emoji keyboards on your phone?
I don't know, because I wouldn't really look for that. I know I have ASCII stuff on here, but I don't know about emoji. I don't think so. Not sure.
Anyway, so if you've ever looked at these emoji, there are a ton of them, but they are not particularly ethnically diverse. They are a kind of odd mix of white characters and Japanese cultural references. But Apple is looking to update the Unicode emoji standards to include a more diverse character set in the emoji set supported by Unicode.
So I'm looking at my phone now, and I do have emoji on here, it looks like.
Okay, hey, good.
Yeah, I just never use it. I always just use the text faces.
Well, there are so many emoji icons on here that I would not know the first thing about making a text icon. And yeah, these pictures are pretty expressive and much faster.
I am going to start using this excessively now.
Oh, no. What have I started?
Yeah, you shouldn't have done that. No.
Anyway, so there are some other organizations around the world that have also attempted to start putting together a more diverse emoji set. But Apple is seeming to throw a lot of weight behind this. And I assume whatever Apple does is the change to this character set that they will make inside the iPhones. And that one's going to have a lot of weight.
Cool. So I can look forward to reading a bunch of tweets with the little blocky characters because there's no emojis on the web.
There totally are emojis on the web.
Now, most of the time. So,
and also, why are you reading tweets on the web
still? I still use the Twitter website all the time.
I didn't even know there was a Twitter website.
You've just been texting Twitter this entire time, haven't you?
That's right. I have. Yeah. How does everyone else do it?
Okay, let's get into our green tech story of the week. We've got a bit of a short The End User Stories this week. You want to tell us about some rare earth recycling. What's going on here?
Well, rare earth and recycling are two terms that you don't usually put together. We recycle abundant elements usually, but rare earth materials, it's sort of obvious why we might want to start thinking about recycling them, because they're rare. And it's not like they're rare like you have to go to the far end of Siberia to find it. It's rare in that you have to sort through a lot of earth to find a very small amount of it. And that is what's happening in China and many other places right now.
Yeah, that makes it expensive, right?
Yeah, it makes it very expensive, and it can also make it, depending on the process used, very dangerous to the health of the workers who are mining these metals. So a team of researchers from the Netherlands and the United Kingdom investigated and put together a report, our potential ability to mine some rare earth elements that are in demand right now. So they did a case study of neodymium, which is the metal that makes a very strong magnet.
And yeah, they these use are that used in speakers and hard drives.
Exactly, yeah. And speakers and hard drives are two products that have a relatively short life cycle among things that have rare earth elements in them to a pretty high degree. So they had to start by examining the mining process from a non-biased perspective and determine how much damage is being done just by the mining itself. And they found that in 2010, when they started the study, 95% of all the mines in the world were in China. And those mines had a whole range of different safety practices, including none safety practices.
Right.
And they had to develop a system for determining exactly how dangerous it is for those miners. And the answer is very dangerous, to extremely dangerous. And then they looked at the environmental destruction caused by the mining and found that it was very bad to extremely bad.
So basically, all of these things conspire together to make it very costly to get these elements, right?
Well, costly is a relative thing, but the externalities in terms of environmental and human health are very high.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, costly in multiple dimensions.
Right. So those things in themselves suggest that we should be strongly considering recycling these metals whenever possible. Neodymium is a relatively easy example because it's so magnetic. Now, of course, if you put it in hard drives, there are a lot of other magnetic features in there, and they're very tightly packed. In fact, a hard drive is hermetically sealed. So in order to get to the neodymium, you have to either take it apart by hand or shred it in a giant industrial shredder. And so the question is, which one is more efficient to reprocessing the rare earth elements, and which one is better for human health? And what they found is, with current technologies, you really need someone to take apart hard drives, speakers, whatever contains the rare earth elements by hand, and then sort them into a specially sealed container that can sort out the rare earth elements from the non-rare earth elements. And so this is all a very new field. We're used to recycling abundant elements, and most of those things that we recycle, you know, if you recycle a can or a glass, aluminum cans, by the way, are 95% more efficient to recycle than to create from mined bauxite ore. It takes 20 times the energy to make an equivalent amount of aluminum from ore. How that pertains to neodymium is, if you recycle it the cheap way, it's an order of magnitude on the order of 10 times more efficient energy and pollutant-wise. And if you recycle it using more targeted techniques, that is, having someone take apart and remove the neodymium for separate sorting, it's 10 times more efficient than that.
And so it sounds like we just haven't quite figured out how to make this viable yet, and that's what we're trying to do, right?
Yeah, no one's really thought of it yet, but the fact is it's possible, and it's something that we should be looking into a lot more strongly. Whether or not you are an environmentalist or you care about the health of Chinese miners, this is going to be a very serious issue for the world, and especially the technology community, in the very near future. It's going to matter a lot how we get these rare earth metals.
Yeah, definitely. And it's something I think we need to address going forward. And is it immediate? No, it's not immediate. But if we don't look at how to accomplish this kind of thing now, then by the time we look into it, it may be starting to be too late.
Well, the way I see it, it is immediate. It's already immediate because, one, we're doing a lot of damage. by mining these elements out of the Earth and continuing to do so at exponential rates. And two, we are already throwing these things out. They are ending up in landfills when we're done with them. That's been happening for years, maybe decades. We should start reclaiming as much as we can already.
All right, so that'll do it for the green tech story of the week. Thanks again, Mr. Marr. You've also got us covered for the tip of the week. What do you have here for us?
So my tip of the week this week is a cool idea from Lifehacker.
Yeah, I love this.
About how to share contacts and sync them between phones and computers and tablets and whatever. And I guess you could probably also sync reminders lists, calendars. Anyway, the idea is just to create a separate Gmail account that allows you to sync your personal data.
Yeah, so basically the idea is that you have a separate account that really only houses your contacts. And then that way you don't have to, put your email on there. And I guess you can set up selective syncing, but it seems like a useful division depending on how important your contacts and nothing else is to you.
Well, this wouldn't necessarily be all of your contacts, but if you have contacts that you want to sync with other people or just be able to send them contacts very simply and automatically, this is a really great way to do that.
Cool. All right. Well, let's get into our app pick of the week. And once again, you've got a remote control application. What's going on here?
Yeah, we may have mentioned this one before. It's called the Unified Remote. It allows you to control most functions on your computer from your phone. And the problem was it worked for Android and Windows, but not for iOS or OS X. And now it does. So now it works from Android to Windows, iOS to Windows, Android to OS X, or iOS to OS X to control your computer from your phone. And I think that it's free.
Yeah, that's cool. That's that looks like a pretty, having not used it, that looks like a pretty cool solution to getting some notion of remote control. So I'm looking at it now, and they have a free client. I'm looking at the Android Google Play, and they've got a free client, and they've got a premium client for $3.99. The difference between those two, I'm not quite sure.
Maybe ads or something, or features.
Yeah, it's probably something.
And I should point out, since I forgot to mention, they are also on the Windows Phone Store.
Oh, I didn't see that in the story. I'll have to go take a look at them here. So I will wait to do that until after the show, however. Let's get into some space news, some Oort cloud news. What's going on in the Oort cloud? And the answer to that, Taylor, is the Oort cloud is pretty large. There's a lot going on there, but we've got
there
some
is
news.
A whole lot happening in the Oort cloud. It is very large. It surrounds our solar system. It is much larger than what we traditionally think of as our solar system. It's filled with many comets and asteroids, which we can't really identify that well because it's so dark out there and they're so far apart. But we did manage to find another dwarf planet. So it's important to distinguish this as a dwarf planet. If Pluto was still known as a planet and not a dwarf planet, then we would also have to include this dwarf planet, which we really don't know much at all about. This new one is called 2012 VP113.
It's a very catchy name.
Anyway, so it's hanging out in the Oort cloud, which is why we haven't discovered it yet. And it has a very elongated orbit. But we only have a handful of dwarf planets in the system that we know about, fewer than actual planets. And so to find a new one is pretty cool. I mean, this is almost like the discovery of Pluto.
Yeah, yeah. It's like we knew about Pluto before, of course, so it's like the opposite. But yeah, it's basically like discovering a new Pluto. So I'm going to throw one more in the jar here before we get out of here today. And did you see the story about we discovered an asteroid that had rings on it?
Yeah, I did see that. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's super cool. It's really. I wouldn't have thought that that would have been an option for something the size of an asteroid, but I guess it is. Now we've seen it.
Well, I think just about anything in the right gravitational system could have its own rings.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. All right, well, I think we'll get out of here for this week. Taylor, if somebody wanted to contact you, perhaps using space in some way, how would they go about doing this?
Well, they would use their flip phone, and they would send a text message to Twitter, and you would want to start your text message with at TaylorPhone space. And there's your space. You see what I did there?
I gotcha. nothing quite like a good pun. So,
and a callback.
If you wanted to get at me, I'm available exclusively via the Oculus Rift Facebook app. So you can find me over there. My Twitter handle is at Chris Hale Barnes, more seriously.
Yeah. Exclusively on Twitter.com.
Right. Yeah. You cannot use apps to tweet at me.
Yeah, that would explain why you never get any of my tweets.
All right, well, let's get out of here. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and Home On. And I was on the last Entertainment 2.0, so you'll definitely want to go listen to that one. You can leave us some feedback. We've got an email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together we are at @theenduser. Join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mark.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Or whenever we return from our orbit around the Oort cloud.